Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Open Book, your weekly spiritual book club. We're glad to be here with you again this week. I'm Alice Shelton and I'm with my friend Lori Strawn. Hi, Lori.
Hey, happy St. Lawrence Feast Day. He is my patron saint and all-around wiseacre, so it's a good day for me.
Very good. Well, I didn't see the saint of the day today, so happy Saints Day, Lori. Well, Lori tells me that on her normal routine on Wednesdays before our show, she vacuums and does other housework and thinks about, you know, the script we've put together and the information we're going to be sharing about, and she didn't get her house vacuumed today, so who knows what will be coming out. And I'm sorry for her poor husband having to come home to an unvacuumed house, but that's a whole other story. Well, I am falling back on my good friend, Father Richard Rohr, for one of his many, many wonderful publications. This one is called, it's a book of daily meditations. It's quite thick, and it's called Yes, And. And that's a pretty simple title. Nothing more to that than that. But it is a very wonderful compilation of kind of snippets or adaptations from things that he has written in his other books. So I have selected four that we're going to be talking about today, and there's really no order to them, no connection to them, just four that I felt drawn to. So we're going to give those a shot, and we'll get through as many as we can. So the first one is called Memory, and there's a reference to Luke 2:19, and the scripture is, "And Mary remembered all these things in her heart." Memory is the basis for both pain and rejoicing. We cannot have one without the other, it seems. Do not be too quick to heal all of those bad memories unless it means also feeling them deeply, which means to first learn what they have to teach you. God calls us to suffer, allow the whole of reality to remember the good along with the bad. Perhaps that is the course of the journey toward new sight and new hope. Memory creates a readiness for salvation, an emptiness to receive love, and a fullness to enjoy it. Strangely enough, it seems so much easier to remember the hurts, the failures, and the rejections. It is much more common to gather our life energy around a hurt than a joy for some sad reason. Try to remember and give thanks for the good things even more than the bad, but learn from both of them. And most of all, as the prophet Baruch said, rejoice that you yourself are remembered by God, which is the big memory that can hold and receive, heal and forgive all of the smaller ones. So, Lori, what does this reflection say to you about forgiveness?
I thought this was really insightful about forgiveness, because forgiveness does not mean get over it. And so many people seem to equate those two things.
I agree.
What I think he's saying here is you forgive, but you remember, and you expect to still be hurt by the memories. That doesn't nullify your forgiveness. If you just, quote-unquote, get over it, I think you lose a lot of opportunities for continued learning. And I'm going to bring up, you know, a particularly sad memory for both of us. I lost my father. You lost your mom.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we both continue to have revelations, both by our happy memories and our sad memories. And if we did just, you know, okay, it's over, I'm not going to think about it anymore, then we've purposely kind of lopped off that path to
that
ourselves.
That life experience. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. The chance to grow and learn more about ourselves and about our relationships.
I love the way you put that, the path to ourselves, because that's very Rohrian words, as you would say, but I think path to ourselves is a very apt way of putting it, that that's really what memories are, both good and bad, if you
mm-hmm.
use them correctly. Yeah.
Right.
Well, I'm interested in the sentence that he has toward the end on God calling us to suffer, and then in parentheses, Rohr says, allow the whole of reality. What are your thoughts on that? It's like he's kind of softening the word suffer.
You know, I didn't get that. I understand his usage of suffer, allow, because it's part of human existence. Human existence contains both. And if you're fully cushioned from suffering, well, then you're not living a fully human life. Jesus mm-hmm. experienced both the joy and the suffering, and we're called to be like Jesus. And that means, yes, suffering, but it's also, it doesn't have to be, I don't think suffering has to be such a negative word here. It's more mm-hmm. like you're letting it roll over you, and mm-hmm. it's going to hurt, and it's maybe you're going to get some joy. Maybe you're going to come up with new ideas about your life that you've never had before.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be just negative, I think. It's a changing.
And maybe that's why he's using allow, and I'm over-reading softness as it, yeah. Well, one, and probably the reason I picked this, which you might guess from having known me and what's going on in our lives at home, part of what I think drew me to this initially was just the title of memory, because of living with my mother-in-law, whose memory is rapidly, as our days go, her memory rapidly goes. But Joan and I have had so many times of talking about how she is able, you know, at the age of 87, with really profound memory loss a lot of the time, to be such a glad-hearted person and a good-natured person. And she really talks about that. She talks about how it's been to grow older and just let go of bad things. And, you know, she has even said to me, she says a lot, been there, done that. You know, don't need to put myself through that again. And some of that's memory loss and some of it's not. So I think that's interesting. It's like she's been able to incorporate all the parts of her life that were difficult and just kind of grow from them and keep them where they're supposed to be. But because of her memory loss, she doesn't remember the bad things. It's kind of interesting.
That is interesting.
Yeah, it is. Good old Joan. She's a funny one. Well, I'm going to move on to another one, and I think I'm going to select the one called Willfulness versus Willingness.
Okay.
So here it goes. A common saying is, God helps those who help themselves. I think the phrase can be understood wisely, but in most spiritual situations, it is not completely true. Scripture clearly says in many ways that God helps those who trust in God, not those who help themselves. We need to be told that very strongly because of our do-it-yourself orientation. As educated people, as Americans, as middle-class people who have practiced climbing, we are accustomed to doing things ourselves. It takes applying the brakes, letting go of our own plans, allowing another, and experiencing power from a larger source to really move to higher awareness. Otherwise, there is no real transformation, but only increased willpower. As if the one with the most willpower wins. Willfulness is quite different than willingness. They are two different energetic styles and normally yield very different fruit. Well, this one strikes me. Does a person have to want or choose to be a willing person open to God? And can you be both willful and willing?
Yes and no. I think it works best if you choose to be willing. But I also think that God can knock you on your rear end and make you willing, even when you don't want to be. As for being both willing and willful, probably yes. I think most of us are. I think we think we're willing, but all of us are holding on to some little shred of willfulness in some area of our life, some area that we still feel like we need to control or that we know best. I think most of us are kind of living in that paradox situation.
Yeah, I think we are too. Well, and I guess the other question that comes up for me, and this is kind of rhetorical, I'm not necessarily asking you for an answer, but it seems to me there is some willfulness in being willing. I mean, I think you do have to will yourself to be willing.
True. I would change that just slightly and call it determination, because I would say being willing is an open door, while being willful is a closed door.
Mm-hmm.
So
interesting.
It takes some doing. It takes hard work. It takes determination. But you have to have that open door.
Yeah. I've thought about just the words themselves, you know, and the use we have. Like, we talk about willing something to be. You know, and so in some ways, I don't always think there's a great distinction between willfulness and willingness. But I like what he's doing here a lot. Maybe determination would be a better word than willfulness. But I, you know me, I'm always arguing semantics.
Yes.
If I ever meet Richard Rohr, he's gonna say, oh, this lady should just quietly read my books and not speak to me.
Fortunately, C.S. Lewis and Thomas Merton can never meet me, so we don't have that problem.
Exactly. Oh, hilarious. Well, just to stay on this for one more second, and then we'll move on. But, you know, the culture we live in, the Western culture, really, I think, values willfulness, which is we term as things like discipline or self-discipline, hardworking, goal-directed, whatever. How do you think spiritually minded people live in the cultural space that we have, the landscape we have, and incorporate willingness?
Oh, boy. Well, as he says himself, as Rohr says himself, they are both energetic styles. So that's one thing. They both include hard work. So that's all right. That fits in with sort of the cultural American dream norm. But it's not the same way. In some ways, you have to kind of let go of what culture defines as success. Now, you may still look like a success if you've let go and let God direct your life. You may very well, people might look at you and say, boy, that person's a success. But, you know, mostly probably not. Probably you're not going to look like the typical success story because you have to give up on what your notions of success really are.
Yeah, yeah. How you evaluate it, what the,
yeah.
as they say in business, what the metrics are or whatever.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, and I, Rohr doesn't touch on this particularly in this one, but you and I both know a lot of his reading does. Fortunately, I think as people get older, within the Western culture, there is a natural movement toward exploring life's meaning and exploring the meaning beyond work, which tends to be where the willfulness is, not always,
yeah.
but certainly the goal orientation, things like that.
Sure.
And fortunately, you know, you get to an age where you begin to examine those things and can think a lot about them and make some decisions. But it's an interesting concept.
Yeah,
I don't know
that everybody gets to that point. You know, there may be some people that don't.
No, that's probably true. That's probably too. And then you have to bring up the quotation, what is it, something about the unexamined life?
Mm-hmm. So, not worth living.
Not worth living. Not worth living. Well, let's move on to The Brilliant Cloud of Unknowing as the title to the next one we'll do. And this one has a scripture reference. Not every one of them does, but a lot of them do. This one has Wisdom 7:10. And I chose to have wisdom rather than the light because the splendor of her never yields to sleep. I love the Book of Wisdom, by the way.
Me too.
But such a female book.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's the reading meditation. The beauty of the unconscious is that it knows a great deal, whether personal or collective, but it always knows that it does not know. Cannot say, dare not try to prove or assert too strongly, because what it does know is that there is always more and that all words will fall short. The contemplative is precisely the person who agrees to live in that unique kind of brightness, a combination of light and dark that is brighter still. The paradox, of course, is that it does not feel like brightness at all. But what John of the Cross calls a luminous darkness, or others call learned ignorance. In summary, you cannot grow in the great art form, the integration of action and contemplation, without 1, a strong tolerance for ambiguity, 2, an ability to allow, forgive, and contain a certain degree of anxiety, and 3, a willingness to not know and not even need to know. This is how you allow and encounter mystery. All else is mere religion. Now, this is from a book that of his that I have not read. So this is interesting to me.
Yeah, this one particularly struck me.
I thought it might, given some of our conversation last week about fretting and anxiety and things like that. Well, how does this, if it does, I shouldn't presume it does, but how does this reflection reassure you about the life we have on Earth? Or does
it? I find it deeply, deeply reassuring because so often I think we're told, don't worry. That's a truly spiritual person doesn't worry, doesn't fret, doesn't have anxiety. But this is saying that anxiety is part of it. It's okay. Mm-hmm. It's God-made. It's not all negative, something that you just want to kind of medicate out of existence and not deal with. That anxiety is part of the process, and it might even be good. You don't want to live there. You don't want to dwell there. But it's part of living in this luminous darkness, as he puts it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which luminous darkness to me necessarily then means that there's learning and peace and things that can take place in the darkness, that there's a lesson in the darkness.
Right.
A necessity
right.
in the darkness. Yeah. Yeah. I have taken lately, I've noticed, to talking about certain things, certain characteristics or practices that I am trying to work on incorporating as being postures that I'm trying to strike, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So that word really came to me with this one, that I can be okay, that I sometimes have a posture of being okay with ambiguity, you know, and be okay with holding a little tension. In fact, I kind of think that's cool.
I think it is cool, too.
Yeah.
And my stumbling block, if I had to say one, is definitely that last part of number three, the not even needing to know. I always feel like I need to know, and that's where I need my work.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting, because that's probably not, I'd have to ask my husband because he'd say, yeah, you need to know. So I need to get over myself and be honest. Oh, let me be honest in public here. Well, how do you make sense of all the education we have and the quest for knowledge that we have and the pursuing of illumination? How do you make sense of that when he talks about allowing and encountering mystery? I mean, we have to accept mystery. And maybe that's what you're saying about needing to know. But we have to accept mystery. We're not ever going to solve all these questions.
Yeah. You know what I find interesting? I find that people who are very learned are the first ones to say, I don't know. I don't know that much. I mean, we learned very early on in humanities that quote from Socrates about the wise person is a person who knows he knows nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's part of being a really educated and knowledgeable person, is that you know your limits, and you know that there are some things that are mystery, and there are some things you'll never figure out, and that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and there are some things in your life that you learn. I remember when my job required me to have access to payroll information on all the employees at my company. You know, that was a time when I didn't want that information.
Yeah.
I still don't want it. I don't like it because it changed me. And I can remember finding out a few things about, you know, family members. And I thought, oh, I could have lived my whole life without knowing that, because it changes you. You know, knowledge is not always good. It's like the Garden
That's
of Eden,
right.
you know? Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Interesting. Well, our last selection today, I think, has an awesome name, myself. It's called Slamming Doors. And the quotation that sort of starts this one is, and you're going to have to help me with the name, is it Thich Nhat Hanh to Thomas Merton in 1966?
I should have looked up the pronunciation, but I didn't.
Me too. I didn't either.
I'm familiar with the man. He just in recent years, I think, passed.
Okay. So I'm assuming he's a Buddhist of some.
Yes, he is.
renown.
What?
So anyway, the quotation is, "We don't teach meditation to the young monks. They are not ready for it until they stop slamming doors." Now, I've heard the guys who are the rectors at our seminary here at the college say things similar to this, so I loved it. So the reflection is, the piercing truth of this statement struck me as a perfect way to communicate the endless disguises and devices of the false self. There is no more clever way for the false self to hide than behind the mask of spirituality. The human ego will always try to name, categorize, fix, control, and ensure all its experiences. For the ego, everything is a commodity. It lives inside of self-manufactured boundaries instead of inside the boundaries of God's self. It lives out of its own self-image instead of mirroring the image of God. It is that superior self-image which must die. The ego is constantly searching for any solid and superior identity. A spiritual self-image gives us status, stability, and security. There is no better way to remain unconscious than to baptize and bless the forms of religion, even prayer itself. As long as I am going to church, it is really meaningless whether I close the door quietly or slam the door. A spiritual master would say, first, stop slamming doors, and then you can begin in the kindergarten of spirituality. Too many priests, bishops, and ministers are still slamming doors, so how can we expect the laity to be any better? In the name of seeking God, the ego pads and protects itself from self-discovery, which is an almost perfect cover for its inherent narcissism. I know this because I have done it all myself. Now, I suspect you referenced offline a little bit that you had some issues with one of these, and I suspect it's in here perhaps. I could
be
wrong.
Yes, it surely is. Well, we'll get to that, I think, in a little bit. Let's talk about this concept of slamming doors right off, because that took me a little while. My thinking on it is it's sort of a refusal to let go of one's ego or anything that keeps you from going deeper into yourself, not dealing with pain, not dealing with your true self or deeper truths of life, but sort of kind of falling back on aphorisms and blank spirituality. And I think we all know people like that. My father-in-law often talks about Bible study that he goes to in Texas where, you know, the line is, it says so in the Bible, that's what's the truth, we don't talk about it anymore. That's it, that's just it.
Yeah.
Or people who say, well, it must be God's will, end of discussion. I think that's a slam door right there.
Yep. Yeah, and I think Rohr would have us understand that it's a loud, clamoring announcement of the boundaries we have, the good things about us, the holiness of us, and the fact that we've basically stopped and shut all growth off. We have said we have reached the pinnacle, we are Christian, we are spiritual, we are whatever we're going to name it, and outwardly that's who we are, and there is no further discussion. We do not need to do any more work. That's just kind of what it came to me as.
Okay.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder, and I think probably because of the use of the words, the mask of spirituality, if you will, sometimes I wonder, are we hiding behind our show, this weekly thing we do? Do you think we're real enough, confirmed enough in the journey we're on of self-discovery? Are we humble enough? I wonder sometimes when I talk about this with other people.
Well, of course, there's always room for improvement, but I'm telling you, there are plenty of things that I would not examine at all but for this show. I would not bother to go there, as they say. So that's a good thing. And I also think we generally admit when we don't know the answer to something, when we're generally confused, when we need to work on something further. So I don't think that we have taken the posture, as you say, of saying, okay, well, now we're going to interpret for everybody. This is what this means, and that's the end of it, because we're the experts.
That's true.
I think it has
played give wide berth, yeah.
Yes, yes. And I think it's played a role, this show has, in forcing me to open some doors that previously would have been closed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so, too. And I know that I try hard to be honest. I don't try to intentionally disagree on things with you, but I try to be sensitive to the fact that sometimes I like to be agreeable. And so if I have a disagreement, sometimes I have to really make myself think about it and articulate it so that it isn't always this vanilla, you know, Saturday Night Live, happy, sweet thing. Not that I want to argue with you, but, you know, we are different people. We have a lot in common, we explore things differently. We have different lenses, so... One of our friends from college told me once that she just can't get over how smart we are when she listens to our show. I thought that was an interesting reaction, because I guess I haven't my intention has never been, either on the show or just in my daily life, I can't say never, but it isn't routinely, to come off as an intellectual. And I hope that isn't what is coming across.
No, I'd never want to be didactic at all. In fact,
we use words that people might not know what they mean.
I'm sorry. Those are Lori words that I can't help myself.
I know.
That's why I really enjoyed that last section that we were doing on mystery, because for me, so often words are not adequate for what I want to convey.
Mm-hmm.
So often... I would say written word is better because it's more considered, but spoken mm-hmm. word for me, oh my goodness, I'm so inadequate in expressing myself on this show. I can't believe anybody would even think of listening.
Oh, that's funny. It's not how I encounter you, but I know that's how you feel, you know? Well, and I will say, as I said in the intro, the written intro to the show on the web, this is one of the things I adore about Richard Rohr, is that so often when I read his stuff, and this one is probably an example of something that this would not have come out of my mouth, but often I'm reading what he writes and I feel like I'm home. I think, oh my God, I've been thinking this forever and I couldn't put words to it, or I couldn't figure out what was bugging me. And speaking of what was bugging me, what's bugging you about this?
Okay, it's the sentence, "There is no better way to remain unconscious than to baptize and bless the forms of religion, even prayer itself." All I could think is, but yet, how do we get to this state of knowing unless we go through prayer? You see what I mean? It can't be reserved for only the enlightened. We're not going to get there unless we do these forms of religion, including prayer. And maybe we don't do it very well. But maybe it's a fake it till you make it kind of proposition, is what I'm thinking.
Well, share with me what you're making of the use of the words baptize and bless, because I don't think we're reading this in the same way. That's not at all what I thought you'd have issue with. That's a hoot, so I'll have to tell you after we're finished what I have issue with. Oh, my God,
okay.
We only got a minute left. Sorry.
I know. How did that happen?
I don't know. So what
I really
do you
wanted
understand?
To do this last question about slamming doors.
Well, how do you know if you are slamming doors? And is it okay if you're just quietly closing them?
I think it's okay to quietly close them, but I think that has to be a temporary situation, and eventually you must open the door and examine it. There's my 2 cents.
I agree. And I think we're going to have to talk further about the quotation that you struggled with and I struggled with offline, because we're running out of time, which is awesome. I've enjoyed this, Lori, and I can't wait until we get together again next week. Until then, folks, if you're looking for God, just open a good book. Have a great week.